suggestion would be to families to feed them the best that they can, and not put feeding tubes in. But if you want to put a feeding tube in your great-grandmother, and because you feel that she might benefit from that, then I will do it without arguing. But I think there does come a time where we have reached that point where we're worn out. And, when you're at a point where you have worn out to the point where nothing is working and you can't even eat because you've reached that point, then you want to talk to your families about this thing. So in general, I think the answer is we feed people, okay? And we have good technology to do that. How about IV fluids? A patient has reached the point where they can't. A patient with extensive cancer, their bowels are blocked. They can't be fed with a feeding tube. They're dying from a cancer. A very unpleasant, difficult way to die. Do you give them fluids to try and prolong their hydration, to keep them hydration, to avoid to maybe keep them from being thirsty in their last days? Case by case, very difficult. In very advanced bowel blockages and cancers, I probably would not do it because, again, you're prolonging the suffering there in a lot of ways. But handled case by case. The question we really want to know is, when does care become extraordinary? When is it inappropriate? And again, I can't give you a black and white answers here, but the things that you want to look at is that question about, are we prolonging someone's death? Is the care that we're going to give not... The worst thing to do is to do an extensive intervention, whether it be a surgery or putting someone on a ventilator, where it will not prolong their life at all. Okay, that's the worst kind of care, and that's why the patients with very advanced cancers and things like that, almost anything that you do will not help. And so you have to be very, very careful in doing stuff that costs a lot of money and doesn't help, and it may actually make them worse. I always think of my uncle was dying of skin cancer, melanoma, widely throughout his body, and he died on his way to have a chemotherapy treatment because the melanoma was so spread throughout his whole body. I mean, he died from overwhelming melanoma, and that was futile care. I mean, it was futile care. I mean, they were trying to give him chemotherapy on the day that he was so... in such bad shape. It wasn't like he died unexpectedly. He was literally rotting from this cancer, and yet they were still trying to do things to him. Yeah. And there are times where it's wrong to do those kind of things. And there's a great deal of wisdom, and you need to be able to really trust your doctors. And this is where we need more Christian cancer doctors, especially, because these kind of discussions and decisions are difficult to make. So if we find no hope for recovery, okay, no hope for prolongation of life, we take into account the patient's wishes. The case, especially with feeding tubes, there are people that very clearly tell you they never want to have a feeding tube, especially if they're old, And I'm telling you right now, if any of you are taking care of me, if I am at a point where I have run out of my normal lifespan and I can't eat, I want to go be with the Lord. You can not put a feeding tube in me, okay? But those are the kind of things you want to tell your kids, and you want your kids to tell you. And you might say, I want a feeding tube. I want, every last ounce of nutrition you can give me. But those are the things you got to do. Now, tell me, all right, raise your hands. Is there an ethical difference between not starting a therapy, okay, not putting a feeding tube in, and in taking one out? Is there an ethical difference here as far as... All right, who thinks there is an ethical difference? Raise your hand. Two or three or four or five or six or seven or eight. Okay, not a lot. There's really not. Now, having said that, it's really the same decision. Are we going to, say the case of a feeding tube, are we going to feed somebody or not? whether we've done something to start with and we stop it or whether we don't do it at all, there's a difference. Now, having said that, let me add some caveats. One, there's a huge psychological difference, okay? It's much harder to stop something that you've started. Okay, just that's just the way it is. I don't know why that's true, but it is. It's much harder to stop a therapy that you've already started. Okay. Secondly, there's a very real possibility to do a trial of something. Okay. To see if they get better, and then stop it. So from that case, there is more information potentially available, but that also brings back into the account that it's very hard to stop something. So I'm just telling you that from a gut-wrenching, a gut-wrenching standpoint, it's a lot harder to take somebody off a ventilator than to say, no, we're not going to put them on the ventilator. Okay. So psychologically, there's a big difference. It's still the same decision. It's just made at a different point in time. Organ transplantation. Okay. Anybody here know somebody who's had an organ transplant? What? Had a new liver, yeah. Anybody with a heart or a liver or something critical other than the kidney? Probably some kidney people you know have had kidney transplants. Yeah. I can tell you, I take care of several heart transplant patients and liver transplant patients, and they are some of the most thankful people that I have ever met. I have one particular heart transplant patient who literally could not get out of bed. His heart, he'd had a serious heart disease. His heart had stopped working, and he was just dying. He was drowning in his own fluids. He had a heart transplant, so now I see him every once in a while because he's supposed to have a colonoscopy because of for cancer screening. That's part of the requirements. But it's like he's had a second life given to him. They're the most thankful people in the world. If you're not thankful and you have something like that. So it is a life-prolonging, life-sparing a surgery that can be miraculous, especially sometimes in kids. It is a great medical procedure as far as the results. Okay, we have gotten to the point where it's almost routine in many places to have one done. The care is very good. The medications you take are very good, and it's almost not a big deal medically, is the way it used to be. I've been alive long enough. I remember the first heart transplant in South Africa, and what a big deal it was, and it was front page news. It's not that way anymore. It's not science fiction anymore. It's everyday stuff in many, many transplant centers across the country. Now, having said that, as Christians, how should we view organ transplants ethically? Well, I mean, obviously we like to prolong lives and turn away the effects of the fall. So from that motivational and goal standpoint, it's a good thing. The rubber hits the road is how do you get those organs? Okay, in the case of someone who gave a kidney, we don't have any problems with that. I trust none of you would have a problem from a live donor, although some people might say there's some Sixth Commandment issues that you're putting some risk to your own life, but I don't think many people would say that. With liver transplants, live donor liver transplants, a lot of places aren't doing those because they've had several donors die. It's apparently a little riskier than they would like it to be. So, you might have some issues doing that type of thing. Okay, but I don't think many of us will worry about that. But what we're really worrying about is, are we killing someone to harvest their organs? That's really the question that you want to answer. Okay. And how do we make that decision? How do we know? Well, again, we don't have that soul meter that measures whether the soul is still in the body. We usually have someone who's had a massive injury of some sort and is being kept alive by life support. Okay. How do we make these determinations? Well, and should we make these determinations? Should we always say that life is so special that we're not going to take a chance of prolonging or of ending somebody's life, of murdering somebody's life in order to do good? Should we? Is this doing evil that good may come? Okay? That's the question before you. Okay? How many of you have the organ donor card checked on your driver's license? I assume in Michigan you probably have those things. How many people have signed up to be organ donors? Okay. How many of you absolutely think it's the wrong thing to do to be an organ donor? Okay. I want to know why the rest of you don't have it checked then. because you're... yes, sir. Okay.
It's partly because I don't know if science has come to the point where we really know someone is dead. You read about these accounts where people are declared dead, they're sitting in a morgue even, and they, you know, those are rare exceptions. But until that's defined, I sometimes have this question of the eagerness to harvest these potential organs. If there's a head injury, how much time would be spent in comparison to what we could possibly do good from it? Those questions are in your mind. Who makes the ultimate decision that you're dead so that they can harvest your organs and carrying the license in your willful?
Yep. Well, and this is probably something you should have on your durable power of attorney as opposed to checking the thing on your billfold. Let me give you the arguments in both directions, okay? And then I'll tell you what I think, which may or may not be right. The first argument is that you stop a beating heart to harvest organs. Okay, that for an organ to be, in general to be useful, it needs to come from someone who has circulation intact. So people who are against transplants, and this would certainly include the Roman Catholic Church and many Christian ethicists, would say that we are murdering someone to harvest those organs. Okay, and with the caveat of the difficulty of determining death or not death. Okay, we don't know the future. We can't determine death. That's certainly a parallel argument to the we're stopping a beating heart. The life is in the blood, and we're not going to take someone who still has a circulatory function. Okay, that's argument number one, and held by many Christians. The second argument is that the only reason we have circulatory function is that we are artificially, again, I don't like that word, sustaining respiratory function, which is allowing circulatory function to continue, and that at any point that we stop that respiratory support, then everything else, if you don't breathe, your heart will stop. It's just one of those things that happens. Oftentimes, the heart beats a lot longer than you after you stop breathing because it takes a while for that lack of oxygen to kill the heart off. So those are sort of the two arguments. The people in favor of transplants will say the patient is dead, and we're just taking the organs while they're still useful. The Romanists and many other Christians would say you're killing somebody, potentially. And then the added thing is the uncertainty of whether they're truly dead or not. Okay, which... let's start with the uncertainty question first. I spoke about earlier, we're only held accountable, I think, for what we can know. And I think in medicine, sometimes we have to make our best decision. Okay, we will never know all the circumstances. But in many cases, it's very obvious that the brain is irreversibly destroyed. And it's not going to get better. Okay, now having said that, there are cases where doctors are wrong. Okay, and sometimes miraculously wrong, the patient recovers. And so if you have doubts in that area, I would not let them harvest one of my children's organs if I had any reasonable doubt. Okay. One of the things that we certainly can do is stop the ventilator for a short period of time and see if there's any obvious breathing on their own. You know, if you stop my ventilator for 60 seconds and I don't take any breaths, and you can measure whether someone's breathing or not very accurately in this day and time, they're probably not going to make it. Okay. I also would bring into the case, and this is what I would say for me, is that I do believe there is the opportunity for noble sacrifice. And, you know, I am willing that if, as far as technology can say, that I am not able to live or breathe on my own, I'm willing to give up those last few heartbeats to save somebody else's life. And I would make that clear to my family that I am. Because, again, I don't hold those heartbeats as sacred. I don't worship those last few beats of my heart. And I'm willing to sacrifice those few heartbeats to save somebody else's life. And I think that's a noble sacrifice. And so if you're prepared to do that, make it clear to your family. And I'd like to say this is all very black and white and clean and we never make mistakes. But that's not true of anything in medicine or anything else in life either. There's a potential for mistakes in just about everything that we do, whether it be driving to work in the morning or not. But we have to make wise decisions on the data available and the technology available. And if your conscience says this is murder, in no way, shape, or form should you do it. And so that would be my point on organ transplant. Let me stop there and let you ask questions because that's a big deal. Questions about organ transplant or yes, sir or ma'am? I'm sorry. Still science fiction, but there's potential. Yeah, there's great potential for things like that. Whoever does it is going to win the Nobel Prize times 10. We think we should be able to do it, but we're not there yet. Again, we're so fearfully and wonderfully made. I'm not sure we ever will. If the Lord is kind to us, we'll be able to do things like that. And then these kind of questions will become, moot points. But there's some stuff in growing islet cells from the pancreas for diabetes. There's some progress there. Growing fully functioning organs, we're a long way away, I think. But if someone does it, buy stock in that company, they'll make a lot of money. And it'll be a great scientific advance. Other questions about it? Yes, ma'am. We talked briefly about that last night. I think stem cells taken from fetuses are illegitimate. That's doing evil that good may come. If it works, it's great. I think there will be advances in that area, and there already are some. It's just one more way to roll back the fall if we can actually do it. So, if they're harvested from fat cells or umbilical cord blood or any of a bunch of other places you can get stem cells besides murdering a child, go for it if it'll work. Still not realized potential yet, but there's tons of good research out there being done. Well, I think you can, I certainly don't want to witness my child's organs being harvested, but I think I would have said my goodbyes before that. You actually have an opportunity to say goodbye because you know when it's going to happen, but we don't always get to say goodbye to our family members, at the very instant that they die, but psychologically that's a tough thing. I pray I'm never involved in one of those situations, but because having a child, something like that, it would be just devastating, and it is a devastating thing. But I have talked to families who have donated organs and gotten to meet the recipients, and it's been a great, great comfort to them. They see a teenager who would have died from liver disease now. you know, now a normal, healthy girl getting married. You know, sometimes I almost cry when I think about some of these. I know a girl invited the donor family to her wedding when she got married. What a great gift. So, you know, and, you know, their daughter was killed in a car wreck, you know. But, you know, those kind of things are, you know, that's, as I say, I tear up just thinking about that kind of stuff. Yes, sir. It's a very fine line. It has to be perfused with, it has to be living. It has to have a blood perfusion. So, yeah, they have minutes to get that organ out, harvest it in. They have special solutions that they put it in to fly it someplace. But, it, you know, it has to come out. If it's in the body and not getting a blood supply, it starts, we start breaking down. It's like when your heart doesn't get blood, it's, you get a heart attack. That's because the tissue in there is not getting oxygen and it starts falling apart. So that's, you know, that's why they can't say, well, just let the heart stop and then we'll take it out and you know, it'll be fine. It starts breaking down very quickly. So, I mean, it's like, yeah. And so once they take it out, they put in a special solution to try to keep it from breaking down, and they, you know, whisk it to the thing. It's all done. You know, it's a great, you know, people spent hundreds of thousands of hours developing special solutions and things like that to try to make it more effective. And it's far from perfect, but it is miraculous in what the results can be. It really can bring people back literally from death, basically. I thought I saw another question here in the middle somewhere. No? Just a little bit of time. Okay. I'll just ask a quick question. How many of you think it's legitimate for physicians to participate in executions? Lethal injection. Or if they're good shot, you know, firing squads. How many of you think it's legitimate? Five? Yeah, death penalty. Legitimate death penalty cases. Yeah, I think so. Actually, interestingly, I only put this in just to sort of give you an idea of the perversity of modern ethics. It is considered unethical by the American Medical Association for a physician to participate in a legal execution, to the point that they will try to take your license away. But it's perfectly legitimate, according to the American Medical Association's guidelines, to kill a term baby. So just to give you an idea, if I were teaching this in a long length, I would show you the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics, and it's pretty scary, some of the stuff that's considered to be ethics in our time. And one of those ethics is it's okay for physicians to perform abortions. So I just give you that as just an interesting thing. Okay, one last poll question. How many people are in favor of euthanasia? I am. I'm playing with words again. Well, in the Greek, euthanasia originally means good death. Okay, and just for fun, I had my Logos computer program. I did a word search for euthanasia through all my various Bibles and things like that, just to see if anybody ever used euthanasia. And I found one instance in one of the commentaries from Matthew Henry, and I'll read that to you in a second. But euthanasia is a term that's been co-opted by unbelievers. It really, probably in the Puritan times and as Matthew Henry will write, it meant a good death. It meant a death, a life well lived, and a death that was considered blessed. It was a blessed death. Now, euthanasia in this day and time, if you look it up in the dictionary, this is the modern definition of it. It's the act or practice of ending the life of an individual suffering from a terminal illness or an incurable condition, as by lethal injection. And we have to watch our language. very often in this day and time, people will speak of, when they speak of euthanasia, that term sort of become a bad word. So they quickly switch to other things. And this is true about a lot of unbelieving practices. You know, we call sodomy gay. Okay, we call, but in this case, we call it alleviating suffering or physician-assisted ushering into death, or many other euphemistic terms that they come about. Much as people who do abortions, instead of calling it murdering children, they call it, you know, a choice. So we have to watch the language we let people get away with. Let me read to you Matthew Henry from quoting on Deuteronomy 34:4 about the death of Moses. And he says about Moses' death, he says, "He dies according to the word of the Lord at the mouth of the Lord. So the word is, the Jews say, with a kiss from the mouth of God." No doubt he died very easily. It was a euthanasia, a delightful death. There were no bands in his death, and he had in his death a most pleasing taste of the love of God to him. But that he died at the mouth of the Lord means no more than that he died in compliance with the will of God. Note, the servants of the Lord, when they have done all their other work, must die at last in obedience to their master and be freely willing to go home whenever he sends for them. That's the kind of death I want to have. Okay, I want to die when I have done the work that the Lord has for me. That's a euthanasia. That's a good term. Now, obviously, we're not going to be satisfied with assisted suicide or mercy killing or whatever other euphemism that you would like to apply to this. Does anybody know if euthanasia is legal in this country anywhere?
Yes, sir?
Oregon. Yeah. And it is becoming more prominent and more common. I don't think we have time, but I would just tell you that there was a short thing in New England Journal several months ago where they talked about the pros and cons for euthanasia, okay, for assisted suicide. And the people, it is very sad, the people who argued against it. They basically said that we're wasting, you know, potential things in a patient. They spoke nothing of the value of the human being. They merely spoke that there were things to keep them comfortable and that there really was no reason to kill them. But there was no mention of the value of the person. Then, of course, the people who were in favor of it spoke of patient sovereignty, patient comfort, patient avoiding the trauma of having to face their death in a painful way, that they could have autonomy. And those were the only arguments that could be put in favor or against. Again, we as Christians have lost the ethical platform in many medical issues, that there was never even a mention of how we see that image of God, that glorious image that we are, and yet it's not even mentioned, it's not even hinted at in the secular medical press. I mean, this is the number one medical journal in the world. If you'd like to read the articles, they're short snippets. Euthanasia comes in two forms, basically. Okay, one is active euthanasia. The other is passive euthanasia. The difference to some extent is that one starts with an A and one starts with a P. In active euthanasia, that would be more the assisted suicide model of giving something actively. In passive euthanasia, that would be withdrawal of care, letting someone starve to death, but not an active providing the means of death. Okay. To some extent, I think both of them are murder, because the ultimate goal and motive here is to cause someone to die. And so withdrawal of care or passive euthanasia really is purely a form of murder. And in the image of God. Now, as I said, I think there is a clear difference between not attempting to extend somebody's life and deliberately trying to let them or trying to encourage their death by things that you do. And that's a very important determination. I do not believe that we can always prolong somebody's lives. A, we don't have the ability, and B, there are times where we don't want our lives prolonged. We're really prolonging death in those particular situations. And we really, now some of the arguments that people would put forth for euthanasia, you need to be to know about that. The first one is usually patient autonomy. They'll say things like, an informed and knowledgeable patient should have the right to decide whether his life is worth living. Okay, and there's that thing. Is your life worth living? And that really is what it comes down to. This is why, again, I encourage you not to let physicians make end-of-life decisions for you with your medical wills, because I think physicians in general tend to think that a lot of lives aren't worth living that we would think are worth living, whether that be Down's children or elderly patients or whatever. That whole concept that life is not worth living is a critical thing that we cannot allow. We cannot allow that kind of thinking to enter our minds. Okay. We may think that death is inevitable and that we shouldn't interfere with that, but we do not want to ever say that a human life made in the image of God is not worth living. The second argument is always that we don't want people to suffer. Great motive, great goal, bad standard. And the third thing is that patients should be able to, it makes patients feel better that they can determine they have an active participation in what's going to happen to them. Hence, they feel less helpless. Okay. I'm going to kill myself so I'll feel less helpless. I don't make these things up, okay? Now, the involuntary euthanasia is just Frank murder, and you don't think it could happen, but it does. It's already happening in the Netherlands. I forget the exact number of people who were against their will given lethal injections of drug because they were old and debilitated. And as we get into socialized healthcare systems where we can't afford to care for people, that kind of stuff becomes very attractive to a government who's running out of money. And we as Christians need to stand up and say no. But we need to be prepared to make arguments a lot better than these arguments that it's just not the right way to do things, basically. We've got to have biblical arguments in front of people. And I think there is a slippery slope phenomenon if we allow some assisted suicide. Even it sounds, they can make it. Every time I read an article on this, I'm always amazed at the people who write these articles, how sweet and nice they make killing someone sound. It's very dangerous. I mean, if you just read it and you go, oh, we are relieving the suffering of that person. We're just keeping them from a miserable existence, and we're helping them, usher them into death. It sounds so good, but it's so wrong. And so we have to be prepared to bring about biblical arguments towards that, or else we'll end up like the Netherlands, where they're killing elderly people in nursing homes because they don't have any money. And it's going to happen here. I mean, people said it would never happen. Lots of things that have happened in Europe would never happen here, and they're already happening here. 5 years ago, we would have never had socialized medicine. It's here. So, and it's, we need to be prepared to give an answer for that. Let's find my place here. I'm going to close and I'll take questions. But this is another picture of how I want to die. Okay, and I think we should all strive to this and reading from Genesis 49, verse 28. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one, with a blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in purchase from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished this charge to his sons, he drew his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. I would love to die having done the work of the Lord with my children and grandchildren on my knees, my great-grandchildren, if they should be blessed. Tell them about the good things of the Lord and go to be with the Lord. And, I think that would be a beautiful, a true euthanasia that we should strive for. And I think I'll stop with that and take questions. Yes, sir.
Regarding the Netherlands, just a quick comment. 2 years ago, they decided that 45 minutes was the adequate time for to get to an emergency from injured or sick patient. But also, I wish you'd speak a little bit to DNR orders, which I think have to be in writing in Michigan at least.
Yes, they do. Let me tell you, DNR means do not resuscitate. It means do not do CPR in particular. I think, you know, there will come a time in my life where I do not want to be resuscitated. Should I get to that point where my heart stops beating? Again, I would look at my ability to function after. If, you know, in this day and time, if I have a heart attack and my heart stops beating, I think if you revive me in a short period of time, there would be a decent chance that I could have a pretty normal life after it. When I'm, you know, 88, I don't think that's going to be true. I mean, there will come a time where if my heart stops beating, I'm ready to go with the Lord. Again, those kind of orders should be, those kind of things should be discussed in advance with your family. Again, we look at that ability to recover. You know, if someone comes in with multiple organ problems and they're dying from six different things and, you know, the final thing, maybe their heart stops beating, it's obvious that we don't, you know, you're wasting your time to some extent to try and make their heart stop beating again. But when that time occurs, that's what you're going to have to talk to your family about. And the that difficulty in not knowing the future always makes that hard. But there will come a time when I, Lord willing, I will feel that I have done my work for the Lord and that if my heart stops beating, I don't think that I need to have all that stuff done to me. But yes, it has to be written. It needs to be discussed with your family. And as a doctor, I'd much rather have you already have talked about it so I don't have to try and make a case. Because families always do this. They always say, well, what would you do? That's a crushing question. It really is if you're honest. You know, if you're honest, the answer is I don't know because I'm not in your situation. But I will try and tell you what I think biblically about it. That's the only way I can answer that patient. You won't normally get that honest an answer. But again, having the counsel of the elders and Christian physicians and other family members is paramount in these kind of situations. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, well, he who hates me loves death. We're seeing that lived out in multiple ways in our society. It is a scary thing, yes. And suicide, I didn't talk about suicide, but I would consider suicide to be self-murder. You know, an interesting question, I'll just let you think about it, is should the government have the power to stop someone from killing themselves? I'll I'll let you, think about that. There's different ways to consider that question. Actually, in this country, we do have that power. The government does have that power. They can actually arrest you if you try to kill yourself. And I don't think they're going to apply the death penalty for that, but... sorry, I couldn't resist. But seriously, they can incarcerate you and institutionalize you if you're suicidal. But yes, Rebecca. Well, I think it matters where you are. I mean, that young, I see people, unfortunately, who are 20 years old and who are in that mythical curve, they're right at the bottom of that curve. They're going to die. Okay. Certainly we tend to be more aggressive medically as far as doing things like chemotherapy and things like that in younger people. But it doesn't mean that a young person, it can't be futile to do care on them, even a child. I think it's case by case. That's always a nice cop out, but let me try not to cop out on the question. I think we take into as many, we all do situational ethics to some extent in these circumstances, even though we've said that situational ethics are not the end all and be all of ethics. We do have to take into account the situation. In other words, we're going to ask ourselves the questions. What will treatment X do to prolong my life versus what will treatment X cost? We do make economic decisions for our family's sake and for our own sake. The other question is, we do have this tension. Paul says that to go to be with the Lord, is glory, and it is. But yet we're never instructed to be in a hurry to get there. I tell patients that all the time. They say, I'm ready to go be with the Lord. I say, I am too, but I'm not in a hurry to get there. Okay, so I think we take what we consider to be and what our counselors consider to be reasonable actions. If that action is going to bankrupt your family and it has a 2% or a 1% or a 0.8% chance of you living another 6 weeks, those are things that you're making an economic choice in a way that you have to make. So there's a call for wisdom, and again, get the counsel of many in those kind of situations. I think a good saying is that we hold on to our lives. We take and look at that sixth commandment and read that larger catechism question on what is forbidden and permitted in the sixth commandment, and then we're very careful about our lives, but we don't hold on them at all cost. There is a point when the cost is too great. When that time is, I think the younger you are, the more aggressive you're going to be naturally. But there comes a time where you can't, that it is futile. It can be hard to determine. And those are hard questions. I mean, and all of these are hard questions. Dr. B.
What do you do as a pastor when you have a situation as a pastor, instead of to the doctor, and they really trust you as a pastor, and they ask you if they think you should use drug measures to prolong their loved one's life. And there are situations that seem almost completely hopeless, and you feel free in your conscience to encourage them to, you don't have to feel guilty to let their loved one go, because you're just kind of prolonging death. because their loved one is going to be with the Lord. But what if that loved one is unsaved? Does that make a difference?
I think it makes a huge difference. And you think it's backwards of what we would normally think. Maybe we should be less aggressive with believers and more aggressive with unbelievers. But to some extent, that's true. If you could think of a better possibility, they might be saved, because eternal it's a little longer than forever. So yeah, it might be a little, you know, if I thought there was a chance of, you know, with much prayer and trepidation on that one too. But it does enter my mind, actually, and I think it should, because we're staring eternity in the face, and we're all staring eternity in the face. We need to live our lives that way. But I think you might try and, you know, is there a chance that we could, you know, witness to this person, they could be awakened and witnessed to and come to know the Lord? I might be a little, and that's a fuzzy answer, but that's the best I can do. When I taught the extended course, I taught a whole section on physician authority and paternalism and patient sovereignty. Very important issues. I think we always should have and still should. No one's more concerned about us than us, or than we. So we need to be. Sure, you need to be asking. You need to be a good patient. You need to ask the right questions, and that's where you have to be informed. And that's where, especially, you need to trust your physician to tell you. You know, I told you, I say that 100 times. That you need a physician you can trust, because what they tell you or don't tell you can be critical. So, and that's where we do have the blessing and curse of the internet, where we can go get lots more information than we used to be able to. And, you know, people ask me questions about diseases that I've forgotten about sometimes because of the internet. So it's, you know, it's a mixed bag, but it can be really useful in helping be more. It never hurts to be more informed. And, you know, we really want our doctors to be informative, help us make the right decision, but not essentially force us into a decision. And doctors are sort of used to making the decision and doing it. So we'd like a little more patient participation. So, and then, obviously that was an extended part of a lecture, but it's an interesting question. Patient sovereignty has become one of the idols of modern medicine. You know, we're told that the patient always gets to make the choice. And to some extent, it's true. We're not there to perform assault and battery upon you, but there's a lot of steering and guiding and educating that needs to be done there to have wise choices. Any last questions? Yeah, certainly death has been removed from the household in a lot of cases. We don't take care of, and maybe I should say dying has been taken away from the household. We don't bring, you know, grandma into the house to live her last few years and die in the house like we used to, in a lot of cases. I think we want our children to learn to be compassionate. We train them. Death is a hard thing on a child, though. So I can just tell you, when I was little, I remember going to my great grandmother's funeral. What a crushing blow that was to me. So you have to be a little careful there. I mean, it really can weigh down on them if their consciences aren't ready for that. It's a good thing to train, though. I mean, it's something we can talk about in family devotions, and you know, when appropriate passages come up, we can talk about death and life. And of course, when you're a kid, you don't. I mean, I don't know what that age is where you expect to live forever, but it's at least past age 18 for most of us. You don't really think about death, but biblically we should be thinking about it. So I think it's a good time for teaching during family devotion and things like that. You know, when those passages come up and you're working your way through that area, if you're talking about Lazarus, or there's lots of times we can talk about death biblically. So that would be my suggestion. All right. You're going to are you closing this, or shall I close this, or?
Mark, yes, Dr. Bendoda.
Good deals. All right. Before he comes up, thank you so much for listening and asking good questions and being very attentive. I can see your eyes and taking notes, and it's a great encouragement to me to be with believers and people who are wrestling with these things. And I just want to thank you for being listeners.